This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. LGBTQ youth are at a higher risk of becoming homeless, and that puts them at an increased risk of sexual abuse and exploitation. Derek Shea ran away from what he describes as an abusive home when he was 17. He spent 3.5 years homeless and was a victim of sex trafficking before escaping to Orlando. Shea now works as a youth leader at the Zebra Coalition in Orlando. He joined us in the studio with the coalition's executive director, Heather Wilkie. Shea says after he got to Orlando, he managed to make contact with homeless services and eventually found his way to the Zebra Coalition.
So I came to this little building with the rainbow wall outside. I'm thinking, is this the right place? Because I was expecting, you know, from the way that he talks about it, like such a big, you know, organization, you know, something grand because of the way he describes it. Mm-hmm. And I come in, it's this wholesome place, and it's really nice and really, really friendly. Although I will be honest, they were very confused when I came in and I told them, like, oh, by the way, I don't really exist. And they, of course, Jason asked me what I meant, and I told him I didn't have any sort of identification. Mm-hmm. And not just on me, just unfortunately at all.
We should note too that what led you to this happened in another state, right? This was all happening in Nevada.
Well, the human trafficking, yes, was in Vegas, and I wound up there because, well, this was kind of when I started to actually try to come to Disney. I mean, when I first ran away, I didn't really know what to do, and I didn't know what was going to happen to me. To be quite honest, I just thought the world was going to swallow me whole, like I was always told that it would, and you know, that's what I was waiting for. And when it didn't, I just, I guess, decided, you know what, I don't know what else to do, so I guess I'll just try to keep my mind off it. And eventually I came to the conclusion, like, well, I know there's one place I know I'll feel, I guess, at home. And again, Disney was mm-hmm. the thing. So I, you know, found my way to do some research and, you know, found Disneyland and Disney World. Well, Disneyland obviously was too close for my comfort, so I wanted to go as far away from where I came from as possible. So I worked some odd jobs here and there, and I didn't give anyone my real name because I didn't want anyone to look for me. Eventually, I got enough money, or at least I thought, and I got on the bus, and I wound up a couple of towns outside of Las Vegas. And obviously, that wasn't where I wanted to go, and I was just kind of living on the streets for a couple more weeks until eventually I overheard people talking about going to Vegas mm-hmm. and the place to make easy, fast money. So I figured that that's my best bet. So I went there, and of course, odd jobs are much harder to come by without anything to give a background check for, which I didn't understand what they were asking for the longest time, and now I finally do. I was there for about a week, and then I was approached by a gentleman who asked me, you know, do I need help? Of course, I didn't want to talk to him at first, but, I mean, he seemed nice, and I didn't know what else to do. So I said yes, and he brought me to a trailer behind a club, and there were other gentlemen there with me. And that's just how it was for about 2 years.
So this has been quite a journey you've been on.
Yeah. I mean, it's not one that I'm really proud of, and it's not one that I like talking about too often. I mean, people have told me that my journey is something that people should hear, and I asked them why, and they said because it gives people hope, which, of course, the thing with this journey that's kind of still impacted me is like these words that people share with me. I mean, Heather included, like she shared with me some of these words, or at least people have called me some of these things, you know, resourceful, hopeful, intelligent, strong-willed. And I look at them and I say, are you crazy? I've done so many disgusting things and you're saying I'm hopeful. And it's just the most confusing situation I've ever been in. It's like you're saying I'm good because of the bad things I did. Yes, I recognize survival instincts. I recognize the thought mindset. But even still, it's hard for me to accept.
And it's obviously hard for you to tell this story. So I appreciate you sharing that story with our listeners. Heather, I want to bring you into this conversation. It was interesting listening to Derek talk about his first experience walking through the doors of the Zebra Coalition. From what he'd heard of it, it sounded like a massive organization, and yet it's this modest little building. You obviously box above your weight, right? You're doing way more than the resources you have, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. You know, we're located, we have a drop-in center that's located in downtown Orlando. If you live in the area, you've probably driven by it many times on Mills Avenue. And the idea behind the drop-in center is that we're able to provide services for youth like Derek, who are maybe experiencing homelessness and need that those basic needs met. Mm-hmm. And so every day we have drop-in hours Monday through Friday where we can provide food, clothing. We have counselors there, therapists who can work with them in crisis to help sort of triage the situation and figure out where we can place them in housing. Mm-hmm. Zebra Coalition does have housing. We are not an emergency shelter. So if you listen to Derek's story, he originally reached out to one of our youth shelters here. And so we do have the Bridge Housing Program, which is currently Derek is part of that program.
What kind of resources are there in terms of emergency sheltering? It sounds like for people in Derek's situation, there aren't that many things available.
Well, we have the homeless shelter circuit here in Orlando. So there are several shelters. It's you know, the need really for a younger population in terms of emergency shelter, I think that our community definitely has a gap in that area. Mm-hmm. Because Derek was so young, but he wasn't quite young enough to go to one of our local shelters, he ended up going into the general population, which for his situation being very traumatized, experiencing a lot of symptoms of PTSD, it's very hard to acclimate and succeed in that environment.
And tell me about the connection between homelessness and LGBTQ youth. Like, what are the stats telling you about this particular population?
Yeah, so we actually in Central Florida recently did a point in time count here to figure out about where the data lies for Central Florida. And we found in a 24-hour period, there were 298 youth who were experiencing homelessness. And about 30% of those individuals identified as LGBTQ, mm-hmm. which is fairly, you know, comparable to what we see across the country. You're looking at about anywhere from 25% to 40% of youth who are LGBTQ who are experiencing homelessness. So, you know, here we see that as a major issue. We want to make sure that we provide services that are specific to help youth feel safe who are LGBTQ.
And then the trafficking part of the picture, too, is a very, like, that is a particular challenge that you have to work with some of the people who've been through these situations to help them overcome. I imagine there's a lot of work that goes into that. How yep. far along the curve is Florida in terms of recognizing this issue and trying to deal with it?
I mean, absolutely. We do have resources. Derek mentioned the Florida Abolitionist Group. We have several groups here locally that are working together to try to make sure that we're providing adequate services. You know, there's a lot of mental health needs when it comes to human trafficking. If you think of stories like Derek's, years of trauma. And so a lot of unraveling when it comes to that, a lot of needs for identification, needs for victim services to connect with law enforcement to make sure that everything is happening for documentation reasons. Mm-hmm. LGBTQ youth are at a much greater risk for vulnerability in general. And so that's why we do see a higher population of LGBT youth who are in the human trafficking system. Mm-hmm. We know that they're more likely to experience family rejection at a young age. Engage in unhealthy, risky behaviors at a young age. And so oftentimes that puts them at a greater risk for the sex trade, which, you know, creates this whole ripple effect of how do we get them out of a system that is so complex. Derek's situation is, you know, he is very strong and his situation is there's a lot of layers to it. It's very complex. And so we're very proud of him to get to this point. But unfortunately, not everybody does have a story like Derek's and not everybody is able to get out of that situation.
What about what's happening at the legislative level? There has been some movement in Florida to try and get some more education around what to look out for as far as signs of kids who may be trafficked and how to help them. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Florida is one of the main hubs across the country for human trafficking. We know that because there's, first of all, the tourist industry in general becomes a hub for this.
That's kind of like the dark side of the the sort of happy image of this as the Sunshine State where people come to enjoy themselves, right?
Exactly. And so because of that, the legislation has done a lot to help increase the awareness and making sure that there's funding that's allocated for this issue. And so we're starting to see more shelters pop up based on that funding. And then also the educational piece, that we want to ensure that everyone can become aware of the signs that you may see when you're out in, you know, your everyday life. What do those signs look like? Is this a business where you know that people may not have control over what they're doing? Mm-hmm. We see a lot of places, even across the I-4 corridor, that we know are operating under the guise of a business that's legal, but we know that it's not. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of things that can happen behind closed doors.
So, Derek, what kind of things do you tell other kids? Like, how do you sort of get the message out there to help give them some resources, or at least the kind of knowledge that they need to try and keep themselves safe?
Well, I mean, it's sometimes when it comes to like just talking to other youth about this, it's still kind of hard because, mm-hmm. especially if they've never experienced it before, it's something that you have to take into account. I mean, like one of the things that a youth council does through Zebra is we actually go to youth at different locations, well, churches primarily, and we talk about the problems that the community does face. And they do ask us, you know, like, how do we handle this? How do we help? How do we avoid this? And I mean, when it comes to those types of questions, like, I mean, people can give the general answers of, like, you know, just educate yourself, you know, have people that you trust close to you. But, I mean, unfortunately, that's not always an option for many of us. I mean, again, me, for example, like, when I left, I had nothing. I didn't have a family. I didn't have friends. I had nothing in the world. And, you know, it's hard to find things that you don't even think exist. So when I talk to youth and I try to say, like, you know, it's not just about avoiding the issue. It's not just about knowing that it's there. You have to have the will and the self-love that unfortunately not many other people have in that situation in order to really, I guess in lack of better terms, kind of just power through it, because unfortunately, you know, you can wind up at any time in a situation where you don't have those resources. You don't know about Zebra, you don't know about HomeAssert, you don't know about any of this, and you're just sitting there thinking, well, what else am I supposed to do? And the only thing you can do is count on yourself, which I really wish I had the ability to do when I was younger. Although, again, granted, I understand, you know, that it was a different mindset. I mean, it's been made very clear to me. But even so, I try to remind them that, you know, even when people say to me, like, I have all these qualities and I don't believe them, I try to make others believe it in themselves. So that way, even if I don't believe it, at least some other people do.
How did you come to find out about homeless services in the first place?
So after about, I think it was about 5 or 6 days, you know, kind of staying in that homeless situation, living outside. I mean, to be honest, I was actually the happiest moments was when I was out there, at least, you know, before I found Zebra and everything, was mm-hmm. staying outside of Disney Springs because, you know, hey, it was Disney, even if it
wasn't. What time of year was it?
It was late November. Yeah, it was mm-hmm. late November. I mean, it wasn't cold, obviously, or at least it wasn't cold to me, which sometimes I find funny when people from Florida say, like, oh, it's so freezing and it's 65 degrees, and I look at them, I'm like, do you see snow on my hand? No, then it's not cold. But anyways, so I was out there for about 5 or 6 days, and eventually I said, okay, well, I guess since I'm here, I don't know where else I don't want to go anywhere else. So from my travels, I had learned that the most important thing I had to do was learn my surroundings. So what I did was I took the money I still had, and I tried to get a phone, because I know phones had maps on them that I could use, mm-hmm. which, unfortunately, the fact they didn't have the proper documentation, I couldn't get a phone, not a real one anyways. So I had to go to Best Buy and buy a prepaid device, which allowed me to get a map of the surrounding area. And concerning the fact that I knew very well that I was in a homeless situation, even though I hate, and Heather can attest to this, I hate asking for help because I don't want to feel so useless, I hesitated, but eventually I gave in and I went to HSN and they, well, of course, they told me that this wasn't a place to stay. They could connect me with resources, and that was the first time I just really broke down and I told my story because I didn't know what else to do. I was completely crazed at that point, so I told them. And I mean, I haven't spoken to them since. I don't know if they would even remember me, and quite frankly, I would rather they not remember that part of it because, again, with the help of Zebra, I'm trying to work to a point where I don't need to even give off that vibe of, oh, something happened to him, because I just want to walk outside and I don't care if people like me. I don't care if they even know who I am. If I'm able to just not give off that vibe and walk down the street and no one has to say anything, I would be happy. But that's how I found my way to homeless services, and then, you know, they directed me to these other resources.
Do you get the sense that a lot of youth you talk to may have the same approach? They're like, I don't want to ask for help because I don't like feeling that I need that help.
Well, I mean, for me specifically, like I've met other youth too who don't want to feel like they're a victim. They don't want to feel like that their life started so horribly. Like the way I describe it is that is a story that happened to a guy who I'm very close with. That's how I like to think of it. And this new life now is a new story, is something that I'm writing for myself, and that it's something I can be proud of. Like I keep telling myself, I want to go through life now and lie on my deathbed and genuinely say, I am happy with my whole life.
So Heather, I want to come back to you for a moment. What do you think still needs to happen as far as resources you need to help youth like Derek and others? And I'm wondering what you think needs to happen as far as education too. Like, what would you tell people to look out for? What are the signs people need to be watching for? What kind of other steps need they to take if they suspect, you know, somebody is trafficked and they want to help?
So some of the signs that I think are important for us to look for would be to look between the lines. You know, I think instinct can often tell us things when we're shopping, when we're staying at hotels, when we're doing things in our regular routine. What kind of things are you seeing that may be suspicious? Does it look like people may not have control over what they're doing there? Are they able to leave? Are you seeing the same people at all hours of the day? Are you asking questions like, do you have a place to stay? Does someone control what you're doing? You know, I think that those are great warning signs. Also, we have a big monster, I guess, to defeat when it comes to the sex trade industry. We need to make sure we're holding people accountable, not for those who are victims in the case, but for those who are perpetrators. And that's a major system that, you know, internationally, globally, we have to consider all of the consequences and what happens to society because of someone's choices that they're making.
Is that a bit of a change in mindset that needs to happen?
Absolutely a change in mindset. I think often we want to blame the victim, not understanding the life circumstances that they've been dealt and whether or not things were in their control. Mm-hmm. And the judicial system is starting to catch up with that. We have systems in place. It's more about identifying them and bringing them to the right systems. Mm-hmm. So youth like Derek may have never known about things like Zebra unless he had places like systems in the judicial system, unless he had reached out and had some sense of pulling himself out of the situation. So we need to be providing more intervention and prevention on the back end. When we know that LGBTQ youth are at a much greater risk for vulnerability, we need to start caring better for them, even in the school system. you know, making sure that they have safe spaces, making sure that if they need mental health services, that they have access to that. You know, the suicidal ideation rates for LGBTQ youth are so much greater than non-LGBTQ youth. So increasing that support in all systems, starting really with mental health support to provide that safe environment so we can prevent someone from going into a system that's unhealthy.
So, Derek, I want to give you the last word. What's your message to other youth, LGBTQ youth out there who may have faced some of the challenges that you have?
Through everything that I've been through, the one constant that I found in my life was the fact that every person in this life, in this world, has a dream that they want to live. And I think that's what people forget a lot. I was fortunate that I didn't forget it, but many others do because they don't see any way out. I mean, neither did I. But that dream just wouldn't go away. So my advice is, it's not about not giving up hope. Not giving up dreams is the one thing I think that can make people really fight for the rest of their lives. Let the dreams be the things that fuel you, and remember that those dreams are meant to come true at some point.
Well, Derek Shea is a survivor of human trafficking. He's now working as a youth leader at Zebra Coalition, speaking to young people about his experiences. Derek, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Heather Wilkie is the executive director of the Zebra Coalition. Heather, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Up next, sharks may have a dangerous reputation, but it turns out we humans pose more of a threat to sharks than they do to us. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. If you've ever had a shark swim by while you're in the ocean, your first reaction may be one of panic. Well, that's natural, says Dr. Toby Daly-Engel. But, says Daly-Engel, sharks have more to fear from us than we do from them. From the Education Desk this week, what we still have to learn about sharks and what they can teach us. Toby Daly-Engel is an assistant professor of marine sciences at the Florida Institute of Technology. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there's quite a lot going on in your area of shark research. One of the things that you've been working on is a shark conservation lab. Tell me what's happening there.
Well, it's really exciting. We, as you mentioned, have a lot going on. Because it's summertime, because it's a season of high activity for both people and sharks, but also in a larger sense, because our environment is changing. And here in Florida, especially here on the Indian River Lagoon, we are really at the forefront of seeing that change and seeing how it's impacting a lot of the fish and other animal populations.
What kind of changes are you seeing already? Like, are you already seeing some things that are having an impact on sharks? Because they are the tippy top of the food chain, right?
They are. They are the apex predators, and as such, they're really responsible for keeping all the other levels of the food web healthy by controlling those populations. And so some of the things that people are seeing is changes in how the sharks are using their environment. People may not know that sharks actually have babies very differently from other fish. Most fish, like your goldfish that you might have at home, just kind of spawns a bunch of tiny, tiny eggs into the water in a kind of a cloud. And over time, those eggs become larvae and then hatch into adult fish. Sharks actually reproduce a lot more like mammals, like humans, than other fish. In fact, sharks get pregnant, they have uteruses, and most of them give birth to live young called pups. So one of the things that the pups need is for the first few years of life, they use shallow inshore areas like bays and lagoons as nursery habitat. So the mamas, like bull sharks, for instance, mama bull sharks will come into the Indian River Lagoon and other shallow embayments to give birth because their pups then have not just a lot of little food that the pups need to eat, But they're also sheltered from predators, especially big sharks. And so our lab really focuses on how these animals are using the nursery habitat, because even if these big sharks are going way offshore, say to the Bahamas, they're still going to have to come back and use this nursery habitat in order to give birth. So one thing scientists have already noticed is that there are baby sharks starting to use nursery habitat further north than we've ever seen them before. So way up into North Carolina, where it used to be that bull sharks didn't go that far north at all. So what we're doing in our lab here at Florida Tech is partnering with other people who are studying shark movement, especially in these inshore nursery areas, and looking at how populations are changing. So we're coupling with people who are fishing for sharks and putting out tags and studying the movement of these animals, and we're using genetics as another tool to look and see if populations are actually shifting north in response to climate change.
What about the health of the Indian River Lagoon itself? Because in the last couple of years, there have been a lot of headlines about, red tide, blue-green algae. There have been those terrible kind of episodes of fish die-offs in the Indian River Lagoon and the Banana River. What are you seeing as far as impacts of those events on shark populations?
But that's another really interesting thing, because sharks have amazing immune systems, and we're really just learning more about shark immune systems. But one of the things that happens to sharks is that they seem to have more resistance to toxins, like come up in harmful algal blooms like red and brown tide. Sharks seem to be able to handle higher levels of toxin than other types of animals like bonyfish and marine mammals like dolphins and whales. Now, there's a lot that we don't know, because when there's mortality, a lot of regular fish, they have air bladders inside them, and they may just float. Sharks tend to sink to the bottom, so they may be experiencing mortality that we're not seeing, and they do definitely die. But there are some fundamental differences that separate them on a genetic and evolutionary level that we're trying to understand, because in the end, we need to know what specific environmental factors can impact how these animals are using this nursery area. Because even if the adult populations are fine, if the animal doesn't have its nursery grounds, then that species is going to be in trouble.
In some ways, is it a surprise that sharks have more tough immune systems, given the fact that they have been around for so very long? I mean, there's a reason for them surviving this long, right?
It's true. You're very right. That's one of the things that we're actually studying right now in the lab. Sharks invented the adaptive immune system, and that's the part of the immune system that we inherited later in evolution that makes the foundation of our own adaptive immune system, which is the part of the system that can identify new pathogens that you've never encountered before and activate your antibodies and make specific molecules to fight that specific infection. And it's the same system that makes sure that the next time that illness comes around, you already kind of are equipped to deal with it. So sharks really happened around the time of evolution that new habitats were opening up. Sharks were the first animals to evolve jaws. And so they got to eat bigger, different type of prey than any type of animal before them. And so we think that's how the immune system actually evolved, was in response to sharks and all the new different types of prey that they were able to take advantage of because of their brand new jaws.
It sounds like, from what you're saying, there is still much to learn about sharks, but is part of what you do also trying to teach people about what we do know about sharks and trying to dispel some of those myths?
Absolutely. There is so much that we don't know about sharks. It's really amazing, considering that they are some of the oldest animals still living on Earth. Sharks, as a group, have been around over 400 million years. That's before there were even trees. You would think that we would know a whole lot by now. Humans have been around for a little while, and we've been studying sharks that whole time. But even now, we're still finding out a lot about their very basic biology, including how many species are out there. But the problem is, not just scientists, but regular people don't know a whole lot about sharks because we don't see them a whole lot, and it's kind of normal to be scared of them. I mean, they can eat you, so a lot of people are kind of scared, and that maybe they don't really want to know more. So part of my job that's hugely important is talking to people about sharks because I find them really interesting. And so any chance I get, I love talking with people about why sharks are cool, and even though there is the possibility that they can eat you, they won't. And so once people start becoming more familiar with how amazing the animal is, or even going to an aquarium and getting to see the shark, people start thinking, wow, okay, these things aren't so scary. They're actually really cool. And without them, our ocean would be way, way, way less healthy than it is.
And there have been some shark encounters not too long ago. I mean, what do you kind of glean from those things hitting the headlines?
Shark attack makes great headlines. It's true. But what people don't realize is because it gets so much media attention, it's hard to really state how rare shark attack is. Shark attack is incredibly rare. It is the most common between 1 and 3 p.m., not because that's when sharks are hungry, but because that's when people are in the water. So here in Florida, we have a lot of great bathers. People love coming to our beaches. It's a beautiful place to live. And anytime you're in the water, there is the chance of coming up against a shark. But shark attack depends on people, not sharks. The more people in the water, the more chance there are for shark attack. But in actuality, you're more likely to be struck by lightning, not just once, but 3 times in a row, than bitten by a shark.
Do you feel like the tide is turning a little bit? Is some of the kind of outreach and the education work that you do sticking, and so people aren't maybe thinking that a shark is going to be something they like the shark they would see in Jaws, for example, but an interesting creature that is maybe not as scary as it's made out to be?
I hope so. I mean, I think that a lot of the media attention that sharks get tends to hinge on that sense of fear. You know, it's exciting from an entertainment perspective, but I think it's really possible to kind of enjoy sharks in that sense, and also appreciate them as an important part of the ecosystem. And I think that in that sense, the tide has definitely turned, so to speak, because people are listening to the voices that are also saying, okay, they're not just in the news, they're also in trouble. They are of conservation concern. Without them, we would potentially not have all of the other diversity that they have in the ocean. So I think there are still those voices out there that are saying, oh, shark attacks, they're increasing, they're, you know, coming for you. But there's now, more than ever, other voices that are alternatives, like mine, that are out there saying, yeah, they're cool, they're awesome, they're amazing. But look, they're also ancient, and one individual Greenland shark could be 400 years old. So that sort of stuff that we're finding out now, I think, is sort of catching the imagination.
Well, Toby Daly-Engel, Assistant Professor of Marine Sciences at Florida Institute of Technology, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Still to come on Intersection, LA-based chef Matthew Kenny has built an empire of restaurants focused on plant-based cuisine. We'll talk with Kenny after the break. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Plant-based dining is growing in popularity, whether it's the proliferation of products like the Beyond Meat Burger in the supermarket aisle, or the arrival of new restaurants with more options for vegetarians and vegans. LA-based chef Matthew Kenny has 25 restaurants around the world, and he's constantly refining techniques for plant-based cooking in his test kitchen, techniques he likens to those practiced by chefs trained in French cuisine. Kenny says the sudden popularity of plant-based cuisine has caught even him by surprise. His newest restaurant, called Humble, just opened its first Central Florida location in Windermere. There are plans to open even more in the near future. Well, Matthew Kenny is the Chief Culinary Officer and co-founder of Humble Restaurants. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We're also joined by Paul Mesha. He is the CEO and co-founder of Humble. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you, Matthew. Great to be here.
Matthew, I want to start with you. You've spent a long time in the food business and basically most of that in the vegan food business, right?
Well, more than 50%. I had a pretty long career as a traditionally trained chef, but I converted 2002. So it's been about 17 years as a chef working with only plants. My background with food was much different than where I am today. Grew up in the country hunting and eating, you know, through the seasons. And then being French trained, they use all parts of the animals and the bones and of everything and to make stocks and so forth. So at the same time, I had this long, long passion for wellness and health. And I paid a lot of attention to how I felt. And also just really got much more excited cooking with vegetables, the color and the vibrancy. And I thought it was a much more creative path. And then my wellness pursuit led me into yoga, a lot of meditation, and I started being ready for it. And then one night I finally got to the point where the light bulb clicked, and I really believed that this food done right could really change the way the world eats. So I dropped everything and started over again.
Because that's kind of a 180 going from using every part of the animal to no parts of any animals
every
whatsoever.
Every part of the coconut, yeah.
Right, right. And do you sort of take that same approach, though? Like you're looking at, you know, a vegetable and saying we don't just have to use what's inside. We can also use the skin or the rind or everything else.
Oh, yeah. And if we can't, we compost.
Okay. So, Paul, let me ask about Humble. Tell me a little bit about the chain and how this restaurant fits into that.
Sure. Humble is a all plant-based fast casual concept. Plant-based has grown beyond the early adopter stage. It is now mainstream. Many, many people are looking at healthier alternatives. I myself started eating plant-based primarily about 16, 18 months ago, and in that process, realized there really was not a viable, fast, casual, convenient, familiar option. And so Humble was born out of that desire to be healthy and to bring this cuisine to families on the go, you know, with all the trappings of fast, casual, and comfort and familiar foods. And, you know, just the research, you know, indicated that there was a gaping hole in this space.
Why did you decide to stop eating meat or animal products?
Yeah, for the same reason, really. I watched a documentary, Forks Over Knives, and from a wellness perspective, it was really transformative to learn the impact that eating primarily plant-based or entirely plant-based can have on your wellness. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm hitting my mid-40s. I've got four children and really just wanted to steward better, you know, the body that I have to make for as long as I could here. And I was really challenged to try it. When I did it for about 30 days, and the results were really dramatic for me. I lost a lot of weight, but also I felt tremendous. I had a lot more energy, had a lot more kind of mental clarity and kind of alertness, and I just never looked back.
Is there stuff you miss, though? Because it hasn't been that long, year and a half.
Yeah, so in terms of that, I mean, what I don't miss is not feeling great. And when I feel like having something that's not plant-based, I do. For me, it's just about feeling well and feeling great. Mm-hmm. And so listening to your body. And whenever, you know, I decide to eat something plant-based or not plant-based, I'm just trying to be in tune with that.
There's been a bit of a trend lately to create kind of simulacrums of meat. Like there's the Beyond meat burger and things which they look and taste pretty similar to what a beef burger might taste and feel like, but they're not. What do you think of those?
Well, I'm supportive of mm-hmm. plant-based in general. I think that it's great that we have more alternatives. We prefer to make ours in the kitchen, not the lab. And so from a whole food perspective, without some of the additional ingredients and whatnot, you know, we've developed a proprietary burger of 17 whole food ingredients that Chef Kenny has developed. And so we are, you know, super excited for whole food, and the other stuff is tastes good. I mean, I've had it. I don't not enjoy it, but I enjoy a more whole food approach.
What's your take on that, Matthew?
I'm 100% aligned. I mean, we all the work I've done over the past years has been to focus entirely on plants. Every now and then, we'll use a small bit of, you know, tempeh or tofu in a recipe, but that's rare. Mm-hmm. But yes, I'm supportive of the alternative meat culture because it's leading people into the plant-based realm, and I think that eventually they'll go further and want, you know, more whole plant-based foods.
But, so it's like a gateway food.
Yes, for many who might not be ready to enjoy the taste of plants. Mm-hmm. But even when we do a burger, for me at least as a chef, the idea is not to copy the taste of a burger, it's to copy the experience of eating a burger, something that you feel is luscious and indulgent, and taking a bite, you know, it has the same mouth texture. It may not taste the same, but the experience is different and, you, mm-hmm. and actually, to me, better.
So tell me a little bit about coming up with the menu, rather, for the chain of restaurants you're now involved with, Humble.
Well, they give me a lot of credit for it, but everybody was involved. We had a lot of input from everybody on the team. again about what the experience should be. Our first draft of the menu, I think, was maybe a little lighter, not as indulgent, maybe not as something that would be as popular for children. And so it kind of morphed. We went through multiple iterations of the menu back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
I started with what I envisioned in fast casual, did a draft, but we went back and forth. And then we did the same thing with tastings and with editing the recipes. So it's different because you have to have, same quality of ingredients we use in fine dining restaurant, but it has to be put together quickly. It's for fast casual. Audience is a little different. Want to have things that are fun and exciting, mm-hmm. that can be eaten out of your hand, a lot of them. So it's a different thought process. So, I learned a lot, but there were many involved. Paul and our partner Eric were involved, and then the corporate chefs in my test kitchen. Everybody really had different components they brought to it.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking to Paul Mesher. He's the CEO and co-founder of Humble, and Matthew Kenny, Chief Culinary Officer and co-founder of Humble. Thinking about the vegan or vegetarian dining scene in Orlando, what does it look like now? Because things have changed quite a bit in the last decade or so, just in the food scene in general. So is there kind of some thinking that goes into, we're going to put this restaurant in now because we feel that the time is right, like there is enough of an appetite for this kind of food?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our research indicated that we moved out of the early adopter stage into the mainstream. You see plant-based food in many metropolitan areas, and even in the Orlando scene, there's great plant-based options that are more local and more organic in kind of their nature, if you will, not necessarily produce organic, but kind of local and not a national type brand, something that could be a drive-through experience, something that could be really a fast, casual, familiar experience. And so in looking at the landscape, we assessed, I think, accurately, given the demand that we've had on the front end. We've had easily 1,600-plus people sign up just 60, 90 days before we're even open, wanting to become part of our Humble Club and learn about the food and, providing their information so they could learn more. The appetite here, no pun intended, is ready. And so we could tell that by looking at the landscape. So we're excited to launch a brand that can be accessible in markets, MSAs, number 5 through 250. Mm-hmm. Where we don't necessarily have to start in the New York or the LA. This movement has come into the mainstream.
Matthew Kenny, this is not your first foray into the Orlando dining scene, right? You had Cafe 118 Degrees, I think, in Winter Park a while back.
Well, my role was a little more limited there. I consulted mm-hmm. on the menu. It was a small raw food restaurant that I think opened in 2006.
Yeah.
And I consulted on the original menu, came for the opening and came back a couple times, but it wasn't there a whole lot after that. Yeah, it was a very early one.
So what's your impression of kind of then versus now in terms of what you know about Orlando and the appetite for the kind of food that you're going to be offering at the restaurant?
Well, as you said, the restaurant market is changing, but I think the bigger issue that will support Humble is that the total landscape for plant-based has changed. Even internally, we've learned to do so many things that we didn't know how to do back when I'd only been doing this a couple of years. We had to retrain ourselves with all the different techniques and methods and tools and equipment that we use to get this done. So it's mm-hmm. it's years and years of testing and experimenting. Every time we write a book, we come out with a whole new category of recipes. And then within each recipe, there's a technique, and you can apply that to something else. So we've actually, over that time, developed a cooking language, almost mm-hmm. like French cuisine is a structured type of cooking. We have our own structure. And then you have the educational side, like Paul said, Forks Over Knives and all the different films that are coming out. So the public is educated and there are more opportunities out there. So I think the landscape is much, much different. Back in those days, it was a very small but passionate group of people who were mostly focused on raw food,
mm-hmm.
which was very, very narrow and specific, but it was trendy for at that time. Whereas plant-based is a whole cuisine. It's much more well-rounded. We may have something that's raw, but that's not the focus. So it's a completely different, I'd say the target audience for Humble is probably 1,000 times wider or 10,000 times wider than it was for that concept.
If you're approaching something, you were talking about burgers before, because that's something that that's kind of that cornerstone of American food, right? And there's this sort of concept of this is what the experience I want to get from a burger, even if it doesn't, taste exactly like a burger made from beef or something.
But I mean, do you sort of approach every dish like that? Like there's this idea I want to get across and now I just have to figure out, you know, what ingredients I'm going to use and maybe some of the science and how to prepare those ingredients to make that fit together?
Yeah, I always start with kind of the end game in mind. In this case, you know, the burger, we knew it's going to be wrapped. It had to be, you know, it had to be somewhat stay together. It's not the kind of burger in a restaurant where you're going to use a knife and a fork. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do that with almost everything, recipe or otherwise, kind of take a few steps forward and then go back and start.
So what's the kind of experimentation process? Because if you're trying to create something like a meringue, but you're not going to use egg whites, like how do you go about doing that?
Well, that's for that specific example, we use and a few other people use what's called aquafaba, which is chickpea water. And you can get the same texture, the same appearance, almost the same taste. And that's an example of things we've learned over the years. Like, for example, one of our chefs learned how to make a rice cheese in-house with no processed ingredients using the Thermomix, which is a mixer that actually warms and emulsifies at the same time. So it's layers and layers of techniques. I mean, it's probably every bit as structured as the French cuisine took hundreds of years to develop.
Mm-hmm. Do you enjoy that, tinkering around with things in the kitchen?
Yes, I don't have as much time to personally do it as I used to, but my favorite place to be in the whole company is when I'm walking up in the test kitchen and there are things going on up there and we can taste and talk and strategize.
Mm-hmm. So, Paul, where are the ingredients going to come from for this flagship restaurant in Windermere and if you open others in the area too?
Sure. We are doing a lot of kind of locally sourced farm-to-table ingredients. We have a partnership with The Villages Grown. They are scaling up production in the Villages area to really support us throughout the whole state for our initial wave of growth and beyond. So we're doing food that is harvested in our store within 12 to 24 hours. And we use some of the traditional vendors also for things that we need to get locally. But as much as we can, we're looking for fresh, nutrient-dense, rich foods from a locally grown source. So we're excited to bring this food to multiple areas in the Orlando market. We have a second location coming out in quarter one, downtown Mills Park area. Additionally, we've got a third location under development for the east side of town and also the north side of town. So we're excited to kind of spread this throughout the city. We have institutional investor interests and franchisee interests beyond the Orlando market as well, really before even getting the doors open. So we're super excited.
Matthew Kenny, I want to finish by asking you, I mean, you've got a lot of restaurants under your belt, right? It's like more than 20.
When they're all finished construction, probably we're like 35, 38. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly.
When you set out on this path, could you have seen the level of interest there would be in plant-based eating now?
I expected this to happen. I expected there to be a tipping point. I just expected it to be kind of steady and gradual over the course of 15, 20 years. Some people said 50 years. But the way it happened was kind of steady, flat, and then last 2 years just exploded. The way it is right now, maybe not. I had pretty big dreams for what could happen in the world, not just with our company, but in general. But what's happening right now is a phenomenon. So, I'd say it's a little beyond what I envision, and that's a lot to say because I think pretty broad.
Chef Matthew Kenny, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And also joined by Paul Mesha. Thank you so much as well, Paul.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.